my honor now to introduce Anthony Bateman. For the last 2 days, he has been working tirelessly to train the staff at our new residential program for adolescents and adults in medicalization-based treatment. And what you'll soon see is that his passion for his subject and his good humor at all times make him a great messenger for his message. He has been for many years the head of a partial hospital program in London, a hospital which serves almost a million people. It is a largely lower class population, and within this context, he inspired, I think, in part by largely by theories of and developmental observations by his colleague Peter Fonagay, had developed a model for treating borderline patients which derives from the developmental observations of mothers and children, and developed ways of interacting with adult borderline patients which is designed to address the handicaps that are thought to come out of those early and failed early attachment experiences. In this way, it's the sort of fulfills a hope of psychoanalysis for many, many years that there could be some continuity between the observations in child development and a standardization of interventions with adults that mirror and are meant to correct problems which are derived from that period. So this treatment has the longest follow-up. It's shown wonderful benefits for borderline patients with a 5-year follow-up where the gains made have been sustained. That's very impressive, and he's now sitting on another data set for in another sample, outpatients, where he assures me that my confidence in him will be borne out. So, Anthony?
I'm correcting John on one component, which is his confidence in me might not be borne out. The data is held by secret statisticians who tell you nothing. Okay. Well, John, thank you very much for inviting me, and all of you, thank you very much for coming. Everything I've got to say is pinched from anyone else I can get hold of. Little of it's original. Much of it developed with Peter Fonagy, Mary Target, George Gergé, and all our clinical staff. And what I'm talking about is not just me, it's an amalgam of a whole group of people. I'm not going to list all their names over time. But I would like to question John's talk a little bit. If I understood it correctly, if it takes 10 years to become really competent in delivering a therapy, we're in a lot of trouble. You didn't mean that. Okay, thank goodness for that. Because we began, in fact, just to put it in context, within the public sector health system, which we have in the UK, to offer a treatment to people with borderline personality disorder through a basic sort of training and supervision with mental health nurses. In fact, that's where we started, not with therapists and highly trained people. So we did start at a particular point, which might explain some of my rather simple remarks I will make about the treatment of borderline personality disorder. Okay. So we tried to pare things down. Now, it did develop, as John said, within the question of a developmental model of personality disorder. And the term mentalization was sort of developed in the late 80s, early 90s, although it's a much earlier term than that and has quite a long history, but was developed in relation to borderline personality disorder by Peter Fonagy. So what is it, just so we can orientate ourselves? It is actually understanding oneself and others and their actions in terms of mental states, that in order to understand people and their underlying motives, we can only do that by assessing their mental states and focusing on that. So when anyone engages in a behaviour, that actually what we are understanding of that behaviour is through our understanding of what's going on in their mind at that time. Now this gets very complex subject once you start going into the detail, which I'm not going into today because I'm going to focus primarily on therapy itself. But it's a multidimensional construct, and if I can just mention it so that you probably become a little bit more confused, but I'm hoping to clarify it. One is that, of course, I'm talking here about understanding one's own mental states and the mental states of another, so there's a self-other dimension. In order to do that in your own mind, you have to balance your own mental state of your own context of your mind along with someone else's. And as perhaps Otto Kernberg will tell you, to be able to do that, you've clearly got to be able to differentiate between self and other and know which is yours and which is theirs. So there's a self and other dimension. The second thing within mentalizing, there's clearly an automatic beneath the level of awareness component, which is what we use most of the time. We call that automatic or, if you like, implicit component, which is what goes on most of the time. The other side of that dimension is rather more controlled. It's rather more conscious and open. So we question, we ask questions and make statements about what's in our mind to someone else, or we ask them what's in their mind. And very often when you're seeing patients, you might think, why didn't the patient just ask them? Why did they do that? Why didn't they just say, did you think this, and so on? And patients find it very hard to do that under certain circumstances. So that's another dimension. The third dimension is clearly there's a cognitive processing within this mentalizing system, but there's also an emotional processing within the mentalizing system. So we're getting a whole multidimensional construct here. And the final component, which is worth considering, is that people will focus, and they focus either on external cues or internal cues. So you can either focus on an internal state of mind, for example, or much more externally, for example, facial expression. And we already know that people with borderline personality disorder actually have a sort of double whammy in this area. They have a problem with external readings of facial expression, for example. They're highly sensitive to certain things. They don't necessarily misread, but they're highly sensitive. And we've made a case that they have the second part of the double whammy of actually not being able to understand their own internal states and their own and the mental states of others. So this is the mentalizing process. The key feature, of course, is that mentalizing, or what's going on in our minds and other people's minds, is actually opaque. You cannot know it. Now, this is very difficult because we do think we do know it sometimes. We say to our loved ones, I know what you're thinking. Don't even think about it, we tell them, or something like that. We think we know what they're thinking about, but actually we don't. Now, this is quite difficult for therapists and mental health professionals because we're often quite clever and we often think that we do know what's going on in our patients' minds, and we even tell them what's going on in their minds and things like that. This is a non-mentalizing procedure, as you might now gather. We have to find out what's going on in people's minds. But what we do, of course, is make inferences about them primarily. Either from external cues, as I said, or internal subjective experience of internal states. The problem with these phenomena, these inferences, are that they're prone to error and we get them wrong. And the whole basis of the mentalizing approach is actually sitting there getting most things wrong. Right? Now, that's pretty easy to do. Okay? So we can reassure our therapists that you don't need to worry when you get it wrong. That's technically your job here, all right? The only thing is you've got to keep trying to get it more and more right, right? Now, I'm not making a joke about this, but our therapists were really worried all the time in 1990, when we started, about actually, were they right? And we realized that it didn't really matter all that much whether they were or were they not. What mattered was whether or not they were engendering a process of getting things more correct as they went along in some way, or at least better understood, or a more coherent narrative, as some people would have it, and that sort of thing. So within mentalizing, it's very important that you take this sort of more inquisitive position, and that's what mentalizing requires. It requires you plus the other person's, or other person, to actually take a more inquisitive, uncertain position, which I will come to. And the second thing it requires is that once you learn what's going on in someone else's mind, or are clearer about what's going on in your own mind, is that actually that's quite a delight for most of us. Most of us think, that's quite nice, I understand that better now. Right? And you have to have some way of expressing that, and showing that minds can change minds. Because one thing we know is that with patients with impulse problems, or with borderline personality disorder, is their anticipation is not that minds will change minds. Their experience very often is that behaviour will change things, i.e. doing things. Okay? And this creates a problem for them and for others. So those are some of the characteristics of mentalising. So where does this develop? Well, we took a developmental model, and we have, I think, a considerable body of evidence that builds over time about the development of mentalizing within the attachment relationship between caregiver and child. I'm told you're not allowed to say mothers anymore. It's not politically correct, but I'm going to be politically incorrect and call mothers and children if I can, but they're caregivers and children and things like this. We mustn't assume. But basically we're talking here about mums and their children. And within the attachment relationship, we think lay the seeds, as it were, of the future problems within personality disorder, and in particular, borderline personality disorder. And our basic premise is that in borderline personality disorder, the core problem is a problem related to mentalizing. And the problem is not they do or don't mentalize. As I hope I've said, mentalize is a multidimensional construct. It's highly unusual, or though it can occur, for people not to mentalize in all areas. But for borderline personality disorder, the key is that they're vulnerable to losing their mentalizing abilities. And they're vulnerable in certain ways. The first is that emotional states undermine their mentalizing capacity. They lose the capacity to consider their own mental states and others' mental states and others' motives when they become overly emotional. Okay, that's the first. The second one, which is very common, can be contextual. Within certain contexts, it becomes increasingly difficult for them. So that can be certain places, for example, or something like that. Certain reminders of things may be part of it and so on. But the fundamental key is that the mentalizing is vulnerable to being undermined by emotional states. Okay? And they can regain the mentalizing process, i.e. understanding themselves, what's going on in their mind, being clearer once the emotional state is controlled or managed or is actually gone. But it's the loss of mentalizing that we think leads to these typical descriptive characteristics of borderline personality disorder. It's within the relationship realm that emotional states are at their most risky for patients with borderline personality disorder. So their loss of mentalizing occurs in emotional states which are usually characterized by the context of interpersonal relationships. They're where the problem lies. So the treatment has to focus in this area as far as we're concerned. Now, mentalizing develops within the attachment system, as I've said. So that's great for psychotherapy because psychotherapy primarily stimulates a relationship, which is be the end of my talk. I will try to be integrative at the end of my talk, not just about mentalizing. Right? But basically, psychotherapy is about relationships. Basically, psychotherapy is an involved stimulation of the attachment relationships between therapist and patient. So what is the attachment system? Well, fundamentally, the attachment relationship is the capacity to form affectional bonds, and it's a universal human phenomenon as well as animal phenomenon, actually, virtually. And it's related to the extended period of immaturity, particularly in humans. But the important thing about it is it's a process of reciprocity. That actually there are certain behaviours within the child which are actually reciprocated by certain behaviours in the mother. Right? And so these caregiving behaviours, and that reciprocal interaction forms sort of patterns. Okay? And there are certain types of attachment behaviours and interactional processes. Now, what happens within this system? There's one thing that I just want to emphasise that stimulates the system. Most people think of attachment as being related to a question of proximity. The child stays close to mum or dad or the caregiver, whoever. That's the sort of proximity system. But the question is what stimulates that behaviour? What stimulates it primarily is fear. The attachment system doesn't need to be stimulated necessarily, either proximity, when you're not fearful. But as soon as you're fearful, it stimulates the system. Right? Now, this is very important because if therapy is stimulating it, let's say a patient who clings to you, it's highly likely that they're fearful in some way, right? If you take this model. So, for example, in development, the child tootles off, is perfectly happy, looks back, sees mum, perfectly happy, carries on, and then something occurs, it stimulates the attachment process, off goes the child back to mum. Okay? Gets reassured, and off they go. But it's fear, and this is very important. But what does mum do within this process? What mum does is actually this thing called mirroring. Right? And when I say that mirroring's not a great word, everybody questions me and so on, but we don't actually mirror. We don't reflect back exactly what we see. We reflect back something slightly different. So when somebody looks at us, goes, we don't go, you know, immediately drive us all mad. You know. So what we actually do is go, really? You know, we do something slightly reciprocal. Okay, it's exactly what happens with mum and child. Okay. Now, George Gagey and Watson and others called this to do with two components of it they said were important, and these are the two components, well, actually there are lots of components that are important, but these are the two that we think are very important in the treatment of borderline personality disorder, and so mentalizing treatment actually uses these ideas a lot, so I'm going to mention them to you. The first one, of course, is what you reflect back should be reciprocal and it should meet it, the expression that you're given or the state of mind that's being communicated in some sort of accurate way that it's understood back and forth, okay, which you do all the time in normal life. And the other thing, that it should be clearly marked. When we give something back or we say something back or we express something back, it must be clearly identified. Are we talking about your mind or my mind? Let me give you a quick example. I'm going to show you very brief videos in a minute. That's a warning to you. Let's check my video man's awake, you see, because he's got to turn the video off. Is that what actually happens in marking, of course, is that you have to be able to show that what you're expressing is my understanding of your mind, not my mind, okay? Something like that. So this came out of whole experiments in relation to mums and babies, where babies were given inoculations and babies go wah, like that, you know, because they've been jabbed. And then mums can do all sorts of things, can't they, when their baby's like that in distress. Mums go something, if the mum goes something like this, you know that there's not marking going on, generally speaking, all right? You're not sure who's had the jab here. But if, in fact, the mum goes something like, you kind of know that they're talking about the pain in the arm of the child and the child's experience, you see, not their own. Okay? This is called marking. Now, you'd be pleased to know you can measure it, you can do it reliably, you can do it accurately, you can do all sorts of things with it. It is a correct, true phenomenon. Right? Now, this is very important in therapy. We need to know when we're talking with a patient, we're talking about what's in my mind or what I think's in your mind. Okay? It's very important. It's not always so clear. Okay? So we've got this question of marking.
accuracy and reciprocity. Okay. So just let me show you quickly the sort of slight differences, because many things can disrupt this process, by the way, not just bad mums, you know. Depression can, temperament in the child can, context can, and so on. There's many, many things that can disrupt it. Okay. So this is just the still face test. For those of you who don't know, it's not so important, but watch mum and baby. Mum and baby is sitting in side by side, as it were, with a partition in between, and there's a camera through a one-way mirror looking at them both. Okay? And you want to, the mum and baby interact, and then there's a still face. The mum stops interacting, and you watch the baby, please. Just watch the baby. Okay? Don't worry about the poor mum. Okay, now the still face. What watch the child? You can see him look around. Not sure what to do, gets a bit uncomfortable, but starts looking at himself, starts playing with his own body. Okay. Reciprocal interaction. Reasonably well marked. A mum who, I think if we ask you to rate, we can discuss it for hours, but we haven't got time, is that the mum is actually reacting on what's going, she thinks is working out what's going on in the child's mind in some way. Basically, not hers. Okay? So it's quite important. This is marked mirroring, if you like. It's reasonably accurate. In the still face, though, the child becomes uncomfortable. Certain level of distress, which you can actually measure, starts to focus more on themselves. Right? For us, this is related to the sense that the child actually begins to feel panic, anxiety, disappears in various ways, which I'll come to for you. And actually, as soon as they start interacting again, recovery takes place. Okay? Oh, there you are again. Oh, yes, and off we go. All right? It's fine. All right? That's what it looks like. We can play it again, but we can discuss it. You'll have to believe me. This is less marked. This is less marked and less accurate. Now it's still face. Now watch this child. Starts playing with his own body, looking at his own straps and so on. Now they're interacting again. Watch the child. Okay, it's quite different. Right, these are rated and this one. This is less marked, there's less reciprocity, there's less sense of what this is about, the mum's mind or the child's mind and so on that's going on. So there's a bit more of a muddle, this is less marked. This is actually a more insecure attached system, actually, when you measure it, and the first one is a more secure pattern. Okay, so you get these distinctions, right? And what we're making a case is that it's more of this less marked, this less accurate contingency that is gradually can lead to the development of mentalizing problems. Okay, the labs have been measuring that and trying to look at that over time, and Carl and Lange Ruth, not far from here, has been looking at that over time and so on. And there's a building body of evidence that this does seem to be a reasonably coherent, accurate story about the development of mental life. There's many other things about that video that I won't go into, but What's actually happening when you measure it is the disorganized attachment subgroup, particularly insecure, the disorganized, that once the distress is set up by the still face, that actually the distress continues, which is what you saw in the second video, that there's no easy, quick recovery. It takes time. Okay? And that's what you find in the lower, lesser marking. Now, those of you who are treating adult patients will know that some groups, particularly borderline personality disorder, once they're set off in some way, for whatever reasons, don't recover very easily. And I can give you hundreds of clinical examples. They just don't recover. Which is why treatments start to try to look at recovering. Now, but what we're saying is actually what you're going to have to start recovering is the mentalizing process. Otherwise, your emotional states will continue to overwhelm you, fundamentally. Okay. So how do we think all this takes place? Well, this is not too controversial, but within the attachment system, you're actually building up representations of your self-state, your own experience. We actually learn about ourselves, discover ourselves, and actually identify our own internal states, emotional states, by representing them, but we do that by being represented through the mind of another. If somebody does not reciprocally come back, we start to disappear in ourselves, if I can just say, if I can put it like that. That unless somebody responds, we start getting anxious. Why do we get anxious? We get anxious because we're just not sure who or what we are or what they are. We begin to get muddled about mental states. But in development, what actually happens is you're building up representations, which are stable and remain. So if people stop responding, we can manage that for a period of time, and then we leave. Okay. But this is what's happening. So, and it's these second-order representations that form a whole part of the mentalizing process. They're representations of emotional states, giving them meaning and giving them context and understanding. Without those, we cannot understand what's going on. So how does this go wrong? Well, it definitely goes wrong in maltreatment. This is severe maltreatment, not just difficulties with marking or something like that, because maltreatment stimulates fear, frightened if you're ill-treated. And when you're ill-treated, of course, you're fearful. And when you're fearful, as I said earlier, that's the key to stimulating your attachment system. So you want security once you're fearful. So you stimulate the attachment system. So you proximity seek at that point, and when you proximity seek, you may proximity seek to the very abuser who stimulates the system. So you have a continually traumatic system. Okay. Now, well, I was going to be a little bit scurrilous here, but you could see that this pattern could set itself up in therapy, for example. You could have somebody who actually is a little bit of a subtle ill-treater, if you see what I mean, that stimulates in a more vulnerable person a particular level of fearfulness. And that fearfulness activates their attachment system, so they need to see the therapist a bit more. So when your patients start to actually need you more, we ask our therapist to say, hang on, am I doing something here? Now, this is not professional. I'm not talking here professional maltreatment. But am I stimulating something a little bit more fearful here? And if so, what is it? How am I doing that? Okay. So this is an important dynamic within the therapy system for mentalizing. If the patient demands, what about that patient who emails me 6 times a day? Drives me mad. Right? It's a sort of proximity-seeking phenomenon. And I can get a little bit ill-treating. Say, stop it, I'm fed up with it. But you don't understand, I need to. So, you know, I don't do that, but you see what I mean? You could easily get this into a dynamic whereby it's actually harmful in some way. Due to the hyperactivation of the attachment system. Right? So we assume that in borderline personality, through the developmental process, actually the attachment system becomes hypersensitive. It's too easily triggered. And when it's easily triggered, you get these core symptoms in adulthood of borderline personality disorder. The rapidly escalating phenomena of emotions, the rapid move to intimacy. I have a patient who says, oh, I've got a new boyfriend, I don't need to see you anymore. I felt like, well, I wouldn't think I was your boyfriend anyway. What's the same between the two of you? You know, but actually, very quickly, she had a boyfriend. She felt better. That was it. Nice. Rapidly escalating intimacy and so on. But yet, the instability that occurs within these, because once they get into the intimacy, it stimulates the attachment system too much. And once the attachment system is stimulated too much, it sets up a loss of mentalizing, which sets up the vulnerability to the instability in the relationships. So that is our model, basically, which I'm going to then tie that into treatment, that actually you have vulnerability factors, risk factors, constitutional factors in your early attachment environment and your constitutional factors, which will lead to temperamental problems. If you add in trauma or stress or other difficulties within the attachment system becomes sensitive and easily activated, and that leads to the symptoms of borderline personality disorder, which are actually a consequence of the loss of mentalizing due to the hyperactivation of the attachment system. If the attachment system is only stimulated to a certain level within a window, you do not switch off your mentalizing. If it goes beyond, you do. And we have some increasing evidence for that. So I hope I've made the case that the system here is actually a developmental problem that leads to a problem in mentalizing being robust in many circumstances, but particularly in circumstances in which patients are emotionally aroused, that emotions within the interpersonal domain, which stimulates the attachment system, will actually undermine mentalizing. And once that happens, you'll be left with symptoms which are related to earlier ways of functioning psychologically. Right? You no longer manage to hold representations, have context, understand meaning, be aware of motives of oneself and others, and so on, within the mentalizing process. You lose it. You lose it, and you fall back on earlier ways of understanding the world. And the first one we describe, none of these are new, was psychic equivalence, in basically in which what's going on in my mind is also going on in everybody else's mind. There's no difference between yours and my mind, so if I think I'm bad, clearly you think I'm bad, all right? Basically that's what I am, and you can't argue otherwise. This is psychic equivalent phenomena. If I say this is how I am, it's no good you telling me, but I don't think you're like that. You only say that because you're a therapist, but you really think I am. Right? These are psychic equivalent phenomena. Right? The other component to it is, of course, that things are as they are. They're immediate. There's a collapse of time. So, for example, if you have a thought, it is an active component rather than an as-if phenomena. So you may have an image, for example, of... if you have post-traumatic stress disorder, the problem with post-traumatic stress disorder is that what goes on in your mind is actually happening rather than being just in your mind. It's very concrete, it's present, and you behave according to the fact that it's happening now, not that it was then. Right? So people run out of the room because they have flashbacks, even though there's no fire, or something like that. So they react in this way within a psychic equivalent phenomenon. The second thing you fall back on is actually trying to stabilize your sense of self, and actually you do that by giving yourself your own sort of story, that there's no bridge between your own mental states and the mental states of others. They don't inform each other, so there's no reciprocal process going on. Right? The only thing they do is possibly feed off someone else's mental states. Now this is a problem. If you say to a patient, well, my understanding is X, and they just agree, you think, oh, that's marvellous, what a brilliant thing it was that I just suggested, and so on. But actually, they've just taken it in and said, oh, yes, I agree, and then they simply use that in order to maintain their own story. But they can't generalise it, they're unable to use it to develop constructively, to understand the situation outside, which may be similar, if you understand what I mean, that they cannot utilise their own mental states in order to have them informed by other people's perspective and change their own. They simply use them in the same way. Now this happens mostly to the severe end in dissociative states. There's just no contact between one mental state and other people's. Right? These are the commonest things that that happen. And the problem is that there's no generalization of understanding or of narrative or what they know goes on in their minds. And the third thing that it links with is understanding things primarily in terms of physical outcomes. So I don't understand them in terms of how you say things or what you say. I actually only understand them if you actually do something, i.e. in terms of within the world. So if you say you're bothered about me, you won't go on holiday. Right? Because if you go on holiday, it's clear to me you don't care about me, because you know how difficult it's going to be. If you understood how really suicidal I was, you will see me on Friday. I need another session. Right? These are teleological phenomena. And you need to build some responsiveness to these demands, these needs, into your treatments. Okay. So how does this all translate into therapy? Well, in the workshop we'll go into this in detail, but there's only one or two things that I really think are of absolute importance in mentalizing, translating into therapy itself. One is that reading people's minds, understanding what's going on in people's minds, is actually very easy to get wrong. Getting things wrong, both you and the patient can get things wrong, is actually a highly aversive stimulus, generally speaking. If two people are trying to understand something, getting it all wrong is a bit irritating initially. Once you realise you can't get it right at all, it just gets really annoying. And eventually, if nobody seems to understand, you think, well, I'm off, this is a waste of time. Okay, it gets pretty aversive, and you want another therapist, or you think this person doesn't understand. So you being misunderstood and acting on false assumptions is a really important issue in therapy. Now, the thing is that the therapist can be one of the people who actually stimulates this process of not being understood, not recognising it, and actually can become the aversive stimulus, if you like, or the danger in therapy. And I think one thing that we do try to ensure in mentalising therapy is that the mentalising therapist actually does not cause harm, if possible. Now, how can they cause harm? Well, I've tried to make a case, just to clarify for you, that the one way you can cause harm is hyperactivating the attachment system. How can you do that in therapy? Well, one way, which is going to sound terrible, is being too nice to your patient. If you're too nice to them, you're really stimulating harm. You know, a really, really nice therapist is a bit of a problem, I'm afraid to say. Those soft, nice ones. You see, fortunately I'm not like this, so I can say it. But, you know, I'm a little bit too hard, you see. But the soft, nice ones create a lot of potential difficulty, so you have to be careful. Anyway, what I'm getting at is overstimulating the attachment system is the problem, primarily. You have to be careful. And the therapist can do this because when they're aroused, you overstimulate them, they're aroused, I said, they lose mentalizing, and then you get some of the symptoms. Right, now I'm just going to show you a brief video where it's quite clear that I don't respond to behavioural treatment. This is quite clear from this patient who basically tells me to shut up, as you'll see, to some degree, or something of that nature, and I seem to not respond. Now I do two things wrong here, and I want to emphasise them, not to humiliate myself, but because they illustrate simply the fact that you can start doing things wrong in therapy, and it may create a lot of difficulties for patients with borderline personality disorder particularly. And avoiding these things is one of the first aspects of therapy. Okay. So here we have this chap. It doesn't really matter what we're talking about, but he feels, rightly or wrongly, that I plus others, he's talking about others, don't understand.
Because the only way and says, we believe Mr. Corbyn, but Gunnar, we have to. That's the only way. I can't prove it except by doing what I'm doing. And still people don't believe me. Still people don't believe me.
Who doesn't believe you?
Well,
I'm asking you.
Anyone else, I wouldn't still be fucking doing it, would I? I've still got to go, even now. You've said, yeah. I've got to go to these people and tell them, yeah. And they then believe why I can't go back there.
But that's right.
I do eventually learn to shut up. It takes me a little bit of time. The point here is that I keep pushing in, which you may or may not agree I should or shouldn't do. It doesn't really matter. Because you will overstimulate patients. The point I'm making is that actually within any therapy, but particularly in mentalizing therapy, we say there's a dance going on here. You have to move in to stimulate the attachment system, but step back when it becomes overstimulated. Because if it's overstimulated, you will undermine mentalizing. Your primary task of therapy is to maintain mentalizing, all right, or to bring it back on. It doesn't matter quite how you do it, as I will say. All right? So this is me stepping in too much, overdoing it, and it keeps on coming back. Eventually I learn about the fourth time, I think I better shut up. I did try. Glad to. Okay. So where does this translate into therapy? Well, if first thing it translates in therapy is in the therapist's stance. The therapist's stance is a very clear one. It's called a not knowing or mentalizing stance. It's the one in which neither you nor the patient know anything about the interactions of what's gone on or what is going on other than impressionistically. Right? You're neither right nor wrong, and neither of you are more right or less right than each other. It's quite a difficult position to take, to be honest, because therapists are quite clever, and actually they piece things together, and they know a little bit more, and they've got a bit of training here, and they've seen something before, and so on. And they tend to then impose that on the patient. I hope I'm making it clear now that actually putting things together in your own mind actually is your mentalizing process. Your job is to get the patient mentalizing. So if you put it together in your own mind, as it were, quietly, silently, but then place it to the patient, this is a non-mentalizing technique. It has to be that the patient is piecing it together in some way. And it's that process that you're always trying to get going. And you do that by setting up this particular sort of inquisitive, uncertain stance in the therapy. It is highly empathic in that about how they're thinking, how they're feeling, how they're getting on in themselves, how they're understanding themselves and so on. And you can't explore until you have actually found out actually exactly how your patient's feeling at any one time. So curiosity is a very important active component. This is not a sort of sitting back curiosity, this is an active stepping in curiosity, which then heightens the danger of the attachment system being overstimulated again. So you have to be very careful. But this is the basis of the therapist stance. The essential component is actually keeping things current. It's what's going on now, not what was going on then. If things were going on then, you may wish to bring it into the current. You move it up to the current and say, well, how does that affect you now? What's that mean for you now? Or something like that. You move back and forth as much as you can. Right? You will explore in the relational realm, not just the intrapsychic realm. So there's very much, as I'll come to in a moment, a patient and therapist in the room. There's two minds in the room if it's an individual therapy. Right? And those minds must be reasonably open to each other. Whenever there's a heightened arousal, you will try to bring it back to what you may have done to create the level of arousal your patient is now experiencing and you actually are observing. Right? So what have you done to create this in this person now is the central issue for the mentalizing therapist, because it brings the patient out of their emotional state into what you might be doing that's created it. So maintains two mental states within the room, which is the principle. So you will stick to this sort of mentalizing process in a somewhat dogged manner, even to the extent where one of my patients said to me, do I have to carry on doing this? I said, should we have a rest for a bit? She said, let's just have a rest. I said, okay. So we didn't know how to have a rest, actually, or like it wasn't very clear. So I said something like, well, what are we going to do in this rest then? And she looked at me and said, oh, God, carry on mentalising. A bit like one of those sort of, yeah, there's a certain sort of playfulness, but she was quite tired, and it is a very tiring procedure for both therapist and patient. I've missed a slide, or it's not in here. That's what I wanted to do. I just want to summarise, therefore, before I go on to the last bit of what I've got to say in this general summary, is that in the consequences of all this, there are a number. The first is, that because I've told you this is about mental states, is that the first is that both patient and therapist have to accept they're relatively open-minded. Right? Now, you might think you're a therapist, you'll be very open-minded, but I mean this in many, many different layers of meaning, if you like. You are because you're focusing on mental processes, but the therapist's mental processes have to be accessible to the patient. Now, this can lead to problems because we're relatively open about what's going on in our mind at any one time, and you need to learn to be able to do that in a way that maintains specific boundaries within therapy. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But the second thing is that most things are impressionistic. When your patient tells you you're wrong, you're wrong, even if you think you're right. Now, sometimes I think I'm really clever. I'm really pleased with myself about what I think is so right about this particular situation. But once I'm told it's wrong, I have to accept it was wrong until proven otherwise. Right? Now, you'll do what I do, I suspect. Now, I know I do it because we have video treatments. Everybody has video treatments, so we know what we do. Is that what we do is when a patient tells us we're wrong and we think we're right, we wait a little bit because we're sensitive therapists. And then we say, oh, you know, can you tell me, because we're mentalizing, what is it about it that's so wrong and so on, and we do that. And then after about 5 minutes, usually it takes me, some other people about 7 minutes, we put in what we thought was right again. Just a little, you know. And then when they don't seem to notice it, we carry on a few minutes, and about 3 minutes we pop it in again. It's very, very common. Okay. I only know it's common because we review these tapes and go, oh dear, this is non-mentalizing, as you can see. But we do it, all right? You will work within the attachment relationship, which is the last part of my talk, and you will make sure that your interventions are obviously reciprocal to some degree. We all do that. But actually, they're marked. If this is you, this is what's in your mind, you will mark it. The easiest way to mark is to say, I. It's very simple. What I had in mind was X. I didn't understand it like that. Right? And we compared a series of tapes from standard dynamic therapy therapists and from mentalizing therapists, mix them all up, and if you simply rate the use of the therapist using I, it reliably puts mentalizing tapes in the right box, I think, as it happens. Okay. So marking is very important. And beware the still face, which I showed you what can happen, but also the low reactivity of over and under stimulation. Keeping things within a range of emotional stimulation is very important. When it's under, you need to push up a little bit. When it's over, you need to withdraw a little bit. And learning to do that at the right times is part of the issue. So finally, what about transference? It's been published that we don't use transference, but we do. We use it in a specific way, which is not a mystery to dynamic therapists, but we have set out a series of steps that our therapists, we try to train them to go through. And this is a list of them, of which the first is validation of the person's experience. Actually, what do you experience now? How come you're experiencing that? How do I understand that? In order to understand that actually this is an understandable experience in this situation. All right? You explore that in the current relationship and you accept your own contribution to making your patient feel like that or experience that. So this is not a distortion. Okay, this is quite an important principle from our perspective. This is not specifically a distortion. That's not our interest here. And it's from there, though, that you will look at alternative perspectives in some way. Now, within the workshop, I'll go through this with you and I'll give you some examples. But you have to believe me at the moment that the use of transference is simply mentalizing the transference, as we use the term mentalizing the transference rather than anything else, because this is not related to insight and understanding or interpretation. It's related to more detailed work within the relationship between you and the patient. Simply you and I, what we're looking at here, what we're understanding here, what that means, and so on. And that's all we're talking about. And once you've been through those steps, even if you've come up with an alternative perspective, you seem to see it like that, but I was wondering about this, you then monitor the patient's reaction to what you've said, and then you move back to validating their experience about what their reaction is to what you've said. Right, so you simply move around this system. Now I'll go through in detail that with you. Right? So that links finally to counter-transference, in which we do consider counter-transference important, and but in a specific way. And the issue here is how you technically use counter-transference. I'm not going to argue about the definitions of it, but we do, to some extent, follow Racker's different definitions of transference, for those of you who are interested. And I think Otto might talk more about that. But the question then is, technically, what do you do? Well, we are open about our counter-transference experience. The thing you do not do, and we proscribe, is placing your counter-transference experience back to the patient as if it's their experience in some way. And I can give you examples of that. But if you, there are certain counter-transferential experiences, i.e. the feelings that the therapist actually has at any given moment, which you will want to express within the therapy. And it might be, for example, these are some common ones. Let's say you're bored, then you will express that with the patient. You say, you know, there's something about this I'm finding it really hard to just concentrate and make any sense about. You know, however you manage to say it, but you will own it, you will mark it, it will be yours. Because it's not the patient's until it's worked within the relationship. Boredom's very common in pretend mode, when the patient's affective states are actually dissociated, boredom in the therapist. Often when you wish to do something, you want to repair something, you want to act in some way, admit the patient to hospital, there's a teleological demand. Your experience is that the patient will only be okay if you do something. You give medication, you prescribe, you admit to hospital. These teleological demands usually. And when you're rather confused, uncertain, puzzled, it often means psychic equivalence is in operation. They give a quick explanation, that's why I cut myself. So hang on, how does it go from there to cutting yourself? You know, this is a puzzle. These are psychic equivalent phenomena. Okay. So therapy is organized around that sort of features of the therapist's stance and certain technical uses within the relationship and stimulation of the attachment system. So finally, if I've got another 3 minutes or something, can I be a little bit more integrative and be absolutely self-effacing? I'm very unclear that there is anything really very novel about mentalization-based therapy. That I think there are two things. One is that we do focus on mentalizing and what it is. That is the clear focus. How you do that, you can do it in many ways. And the second thing is we avoid what we consider to be possibly harmful techniques. Those are the two things, basically. Now, what that suggests is that many therapists could be mentalizing therapists. That actually, if you develop an interactional matrix that becomes the focus of the treatment between you and the patient, it's likely to be reasonably mentalizing. It's likely to be something that's concerned about what's going on in the patient's mind. It's likely that the therapist will start representing what he or she understands is going on in the patient's mind. Okay? It depends how they put it to the patient, okay? Mostly. Right? It's likely that you're going to develop a mentalizing process. And what we're interested in, and we've stated many, many times, is not so much content, not so much technique-specific phenomena, but actually does what you do engage the patient into a mentalizing process? And if it does that, we think that the patients with borderline personality disorder will gradually change because they will continue to maintain representational levels of mental function, even in emotional states. So some people have looked at the overlap of different therapies, this is in Journal of Personality Disorders, of techniques that are used, and they try to categorize the techniques and place them together. And this is taken from that paper. And you can see that fundamentally there are differences in emphases, but actually there's an awful lot of overlap. Now, if I could be not so self-effacing, say maybe the middle bit of that Venn diagram is mentalizing. You know, basically they're all moving to stimulate that process. You're just doing it in different ways. And as you can see, they all use some psychoeducation as motivational process, the dynamics, of course, of more relational, generally, and things like that. But overall, there's a huge overlap between these treatments. And there are certainly many common factors between them, both in the structure as well as in actually what they do when they're talking with patients. So the therapies will stimulate the attachment system, right? That is a prerequisite to help the patients begin to mentalize at the time when they normally lose it. So they learn to mentalize even when they lose it. Or a patient of mine, I gave the example yesterday in the seminar, just because it's one recent one, in the supermarket, does her little piece of shopping, gets to the checkout desk, and just as she's about to put her basket on, a man walks in front of her and puts his on. Right? Pretty annoying for anyone. It's very annoying for her, because it was a man as well, and she, you know, but nevertheless, it's pretty annoying. So what would you do? You'd hopefully feel somewhat annoyed, a little bit, you know, out there or something, you'd say, excuse me, or something, I think I was next, rather politely. And if they turn around and said, you know, they'd think, oh no, it's quite all right. You know, but you'd probably continue mentalising to some degree, all right? What did my patient do? She didn't take any note of this rather huge man at all. She picked up his thing, flung it across, slammed hers down and said to the checkout lady, I was here. Right. And she, of course, pressed the alarm, sensibly, and the police came, and there was a lot of trouble. Right? Now, she didn't continue mentalizing. Now, what you want to do is actually help her continue the process of some sort of representation and how to manage that in this context. So you stimulate that to some extent in therapy. I mean, not literally, obviously, but the stimulation of the attachment system so that they... And then you help them maintain mentalizing. And many, many therapies will try to do that. Right? Can I just suggest that the coaching, telephone coaching in DBT, I'm going to have to be careful because we've got three therapists, so I don't want to talk about other people's therapists, but is a highly mentalizing process. That's actually what you're doing from our perspective, is trying to help the patient maintain some capacities whilst they're in crisis. So most therapies, I hope, will be mentalistic. So we produced a principle for treatments of borderline personality disorder that actually many therapies might do harm for individuals. That's one thing we have written about. So in the end, therapeutic treatment for borderline personality will be effective to the extent that it can enhance someone's mentalizing capacity. If that's what we suggest is a reasonable hypothesis and a key, as long as you don't introduce any harmful effects as well within your treatment itself. Right? And the harmful effects are likely to be reduced if the intensity of the interaction between patients and therapists is carefully titrated to the patient's actual capacities. Okay? So then you will not overstimulate or understimulate your patients. So increase the mentalizing, decrease any potential harmful phenomena, then I think our patients have a much better outcome. Thanks very much.